Hello, I'm Janelle Anderson, and welcome to Human Proof of Concept, the Biotech Venture Capital Podcast. Alix Lacoste was once a self-described lost soul from France, who made her way to California, ran out of money, and studied filmmaking in community college. Today, she's a subject matter expert at IBM's internal venture, Watson. You may remember IBM Watson from such disruptions as winning Jeopardy against humans in 2011. Now it's disrupting drug discovery as part of its effort in health. Alix discusses some examples of how it's tackling that challenge, including partnering with pharma companies and institutes to find unique disease genes. You might say there's a new paradigm in genetics, Watson and Click. Stay tuned. Alix Lacoste, many thanks for joining me on the Human Proof of Concept podcast today.
It's my pleasure.
Well, it's that time of year when droves of summer students have arrived in research labs around the country. But there is a 10-year-old that's burst onto the drug discovery scene. Still a kid, but a scientist in training, reputed to be a great collaborator and really helpful around the lab. We'll read your papers for you, point out patterns, suggest genetic targets, opportunities for repurposing, and more. Did I mention he won Jeopardy when he was only 4 years old? I'm speaking, of course, of IBM Watson. Alix, could you tell us what Watson is and what's the purpose of it now being directed towards drug discovery?
Sure. So Watson is really a big gamble in some sense by IBM. It really started in research as a research program in 2004 and then developed up to 2011 when it won Jeopardy against the two champions. And our first partnership really was with Memory Sloan Kettering after building the business unit of Watson. And so the first vertical business unit now is Watson Health. We recognize that there is so much untapped potential in the healthcare space. Healthcare is expensive, it's really inefficient, and there is just a wealth of data out there that can help all the way from preclinical work and drug discovery to patients' office and then follow up in offices and also in home care.
Great. Now, you have a PhD in molecular and cellular biology. You're a Berkeley and Harvard trained scientist. Is your job at IBM simply put to train a robot scientist?
No, it's not just to, you know, give it food or what some of my friends joke about. I have a lot of jobs within IBM because I'm in a unique position of being a subject matter expert in biology and also understanding the technology and being really fascinated by technology ever since I started my PhD, really thinking about computational approaches to solving problems. So my job is to find out what the use cases are. So I work with clients on their particular problems that are business problems, day-to-day problems in the lab, or also even in marketing, and thinking about how we can apply the Watson technology to their specific problems. And so I work both with the clients on the questions and then with the engineers, the computer scientist, even the designer to design products and algorithm that can help to solve the scientist's questions. So it's a fascinating job that I have. I'm very lucky. I get to really play a big part in building a product that's being used to accelerate research and development.
I feel like it might take IBM Watson just to understand the organizational taxonomy of IBM Watson.
That's right.
You alluded to it before, but you've got the big blue IBM parent company. Watson is a group within that, or a vertical or a division?
How yeah, is that it's structured? A vertical division.
Okay. And within that, there's IBM Watson Health, and I gather a subset of that is IBM Watson for drug discovery. Do I have that correct?
Right. So we have business units within IBM Watson Health, one of which is life sciences. Mm-hmm. We have IBM for drug discovery, also IBM for patient safety. So it's actually a collection of a few offerings within IBM Watson and then IBM Watson for life sciences.
I see. And is your group largely co-located in New York or is it geographically dispersed?
It's very geographically dispersed. The research labs are primarily in Yorktown Heights in New York and then also in California. But also we have really excellent research in Israel, a new research lab in Africa. And then we have clients that are geographically dispersed. And, you know, we also have the big pharma clients, some in Germany, et cetera. So it's really globally distributed, and the amount of talent that comes together is really incredible to see. At IBM, I really like our approach and the way that our CEO, Jenny Rometty, thinks about artificial intelligence. We really think about it as cognitive computing and as enhancing human knowledge and capacity and not as replacing it. So I know that there's a lot of bad press, you know, about artificial intelligence, and I do understand the concerns that people have. However, I really think it has the potential to just scale human expertise and not replace it. And all the projects I worked on, it really, we need the experts and all kinds of other people to work on these projects, because the machine on its own, it's only as good as you train it to be. It's really a partnership between the computer and the human. And I do think artificial intelligence has the potential to help society. And I definitely, that's why I'm in drug discovery and in health. I think we really can apply these tools towards making better society.
Hmm. That's great. And what is interesting, IBM is decidedly not a pharma or a biotech. So as you say, Watson needs good research questions to chew on, and IBM isn't creating drugs. So you have to have these partnerships. Could you briefly describe the role and goal when IBM Watson joins forces with them?
Yeah, absolutely. I can tell you about a few projects, maybe one that comes to mind that has been really successful and that I've been very much a part of since the beginning, is with Baroneurological, and that's around ALS, so amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, also called Lou Gehrig's disease. It's really a devastating condition, and there's no cure, and at time of diagnosis, it's only a few years left to live for the patients. So Baroneurological is actually a leader in ALS research, and they came to us, having seen, you know, the ads on TV, I think, and they were wondering whether we could help them accelerate their research. So we had a workshop with them. You know, we sat together with the scientists, and they had a lot of problems. Some problems, honestly, we're not sophisticated enough to solve. You know, if the data is not available out there, either in the literature or other type of structured data sources, then, you know, we can't make it up, right? So we need data. And so after a day of workshop, we came to a really interesting question that has very high value for them. And that is that we know that there are some genes in the human genome that are correlated with ALS. And these are genes that code for proteins that are called RNA binding proteins. And these proteins, there are 8 of them that have mutations that are linked to developing ALS. And so you can imagine that you could design drugs that would target these proteins, right, and actually provide a curative treatment that is completely lacking at this point. So scientists know a few of these. However, there are 1,500 of these proteins in the human genome. So you can imagine that going one by one would take years. I mean, grad students, I think you've been a grad student, you know that we're a little bit like machines sometimes, but we just simply, you know, we're not supercomputers. We can only read a few articles a day. So the researchers said, you know, it would take us years to look at each one of them, evaluate the evidence, say, is this a good target to go after? Does it have a chance to be linked to ALS? So what we did is that Watson for Drug Discovery, it's ingesting millions of documents from the literature. So we have millions of abstracts, all of the biomedical literature that's available on PubMed. We also have some full text documents. We have patents, textbooks, etc. We can also take in the client's private data, but in this instance, we just used a public instance with the literature that's freely available. And what we did is that Watson basically reads all these articles and it recognizes all these proteins. It also will recognize all of the diseases. It recognizes drugs and chemicals. And then out of these, what we call entities, these drugs and chemicals, et cetera, we build a network graph of relationships. So let's say gene A is related to gene B and also affects drug X, which is used for disease Y. So we have a giant network in seconds. You can actually bring it it up in our product where you can see all of these relationships. So not only do you get the knowledge at your fingertips, right? Something that it would take years to just do yourself, even poor grad students in the lab. And what's more is that we've developed technologies, and this is really where the AI part comes, and the machine learning, to make algorithms that will predict new relationships based on this network that's automatically generated from the literature. So doing that, what we said is, well, let's look at these 1,500 proteins. Let's look at their patterns. And let's see what's special about these proteins that we know are connected to ALS. Let's look at the 1,500 others. Do they have these patterns from the text? This, we call it semantic similarity. So are the words and phrases that are used around these proteins similar to the ones that we know are linked to ALS? So we did that, and what Watson came up with was a ranked ordered list of these proteins. And we can also provide some evidence as to why Watson thinks there is and there might be a relationship there. So what Bayer Neurological did is they took the top 10 and they said, okay, we'll test those in the lab and mm-hmm. see how Watson does. So, you know, very exciting for us. And what they did is immunohistochemistry to look at the localization and expression of proteins in cells. And so you can expect that if a protein is involved in a specific disease state, if you take the tissue samples of the patients that have this disease, you will see that the protein is different in those patients in this tissue versus tissue from normal patients. So they did that, and to our amazing surprise, they found that 8 out of the 10 were actually different in ALS patients, which, you know, by chance, it's just completely improbable, right? So it took a process that would have taken years, and, you know, we really reduced it to a few weeks. The experiments, of course, take a while.
Sure.
But it's only really a year. So Watson did the ranking. We had the workshop. And again, it was a partnership to figure out how to train the system appropriately. It took a few weeks. And then the experiments took, you know, the rest of the year. But then they came out with these 8. And what's amazing is that 5 of those had never been linked to ALS. So there's nothing that the researchers could find, even in supplementary data that Watson didn't have access to or anywhere else, that linked those proteins to ALS. I remember there was even in the top 10, I was a bit nervous because one of them, Watson only had 7 documents for it, 7 abstracts actually,
oh, wow,
that talked about it. And there was no mention of ALS specifically, right? But it recognized in the patterns of the words in those abstracts that it was similar to words that were used for proteins that are linked to ALS. And Syncrypt, that's one of them. It turns out that it was shown to be linked to ALS in the Bayer Neurological experiments.
Wow. And in that partnership, or in any partnership, whose responsibility is it for framing the question, the original question, and who selects the massive amount of data for inputs?
Right. Yeah. Excellent question. It really, that's why we have a day or even sometimes 2-day workshops with the scientists, because we understand the technology on the IBM side, and they obviously have deep expertise into the problems, right? And so what we do at first is they explain their research to us and the main unknowns in their field and the main knowns, obviously. And then we explain the technology, and then we're both digesting, sometimes overnight. Yeah. And then we come back and we say, okay, these are the types of questions that we think we can tackle. And so again, it really, you know, Watson for drug discovery is still pretty young. There are some things that it doesn't know very much about, like brain structures, you know, so you can't really ask a question about, well, is this protein involved, you know, in the prefrontal cortex or a specific substructure, because Watson, we haven't trained it yet to recognize those particular mentions in text. But that said, so for example, with Pfizer, we developed a new adverse event annotator. So previously, we weren't able to recognize those, and then we did. So it involves building dictionaries and then, you know, making rules and training the system to also disambiguate the language. Because you can imagine there are a lot of acronyms that scientists use. And often one acronym can mean several things. So you need to use the context, right, to do that. So to come back to your question, how do we develop the question? It's definitely, it requires some understanding of the technology, what it can do, what it can't do. Mm-hmm. And we really try to go after the most important problems.
Oh, as you're saying that, I was thinking, I bet Watson could unblind a clinical trial in no time flat.
Yeah,
just
probably,
by looking at the adverse events or the any data that's being reported out.
And there is actually an offering that we have that is using clinics that is called clinical trial matching. It's specifically for cancer right now, but it helps doctors, based on the patient's history and lab results, et cetera, find the right clinical trials for them, which is, again, you know, in our goal of getting to treatment faster, it's a really important step.
Right. So you talked about the input and the framing. What about the output? Who owns the output?
So the output is really owned by the clients. Mm-hmm. So we only own the technology, and then whatever we learn from the technology is owned by the clients. So in the example of Pfizer, we developed new technology, new predictive algorithms, actually, and as I was saying, new annotators. So everything that we built is ours, but then all of the knowledge that is gained from those new technologies is Pfizer's.
Right.
So, you know, I have friends who tell me, well, why don't you, you know, as IBM, go after these targets yourself? You could sell the insights, right, in some ways. I think it's an interesting model. I do think that, as we were saying before, the expertise of our partners is just invaluable. Mm-hmm. So I think at this point, it makes more sense and it's more fun to work with partners.
Aren't stock markets and major league sports prime substrate for Watson? Why not focus on predicting them?
So I do think I don't know very much about outside of health, because that's near and dear to my heart. However, I do think there are solutions in the financial market. I just cannot say very much about them.
Fair enough. What are the limitations of IBM Watson? Meaning, at what point is it saturated and can't usefully learn anymore?
That's a great question. What's really important in general in making predictions is to understand what are the important variables, what are the important features that will make a great model. So you can throw a great model, you know, or a great algorithm at a question and get nothing out of it because you didn't select the right features appropriately. So in our case, you know, sometimes when we work with partners in drug discovery, for example, perhaps we didn't focus on the right features. So we didn't do the right training. We didn't, we included some drugs in the training set that shouldn't be in there. And sometimes it requires us to, in some ways, simplify the problems. You know, you worked in science, you know that it's really easy to get bogged down in the detail because everything is so much more complicated than you think. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you just have to take a step back and say, okay, we're going to make this assumption, or we're going to ignore this element because we can't just go to that level of detail at this point if we really want to accelerate discovery. Because in some sense, also, there's a lot of data out there that is imperfect. And so I think sometimes simplifying, well, you can also, you might be getting rid of noise to some extent as well.
Mm-hmm. So this reminds me that Derek Lowe pondered in his In the Pipeline blog a few months ago whether there was too much quote-unquote crap and gaps in the literature or not enough negative results to render scientific publications a sufficient input source for Watson. What do you think about that? How do you handle it?
Yeah, so I think it's definitely true that there isn't enough negative data in the sciences, and that's because of the reward system that we have, right, where we don't reward publishing negative data. Nobody is interested in it, even though a few people really are because they're working on it, and I've definitely, I know grad students who wasted years following up on bad data that was published by different labs. So I do think that we actually don't, if coming back to pharma company and their own proprietary data, I don't think we or they follow up enough on that data that didn't work out. You know, we often even focus on the good data. In terms of Watson, we're actually working right now on a system to provide a confidence in the likelihood that an interaction that we extract from the literature is true or not. And, you know, we have to actually worked on that with the computer scientists, and we have to make a few assumptions. And one of them is that if there is a relationship that is unlikely based on other patterns is likely to be false, mm-hmm. right? But it is an assumption. It's basically saying that new discoveries should actually be predicted by a computer, right? And if they're not, then they might be false. And so our challenge is always to find actually the negative data and to find the false interaction so that we can test our system and make sure that our model is correct at predicting relationships with high confidence. So we have done that to some extent. And I think at the end of the day, what we see, at least in the projects that I've worked on, is that I do actually, I hold my breath a lot. I cross my fingers. Sometimes I'm like, how does this even work? And it does. It's actually quite incredible. You know, I'm definitely a skeptical scientist, but then I see it work. And I think what's happening is that there is noise, but in the noise, there's really still the signal is being pushed forward. So I think drug discovery, there's a 12% chance that a drug will be approved from when it starts to enter clinical trials. And if we can just push that to, you know, 50%, 80%, that would make a huge difference, right? So we're not trying to say everything that we predict is going to turn out to be correct. I'm also working on a drug repurposing project where there are some of the top candidates that Watson came up with where the scientists said, no, that doesn't work out because of this and that reason. And sometimes they will say, actually Watson is basing its evidence on a few papers that maybe it didn't understand it correctly, or maybe they don't trust the science. So it's really, really important to always show the evidence mm-hmm. for the predictions so that the experts can evaluate that evidence and with their knowledge say whether they do trust it or not. But the initial ranking of candidates is really an unbiased process that I think is incredibly valuable because as human, we do have a lot of biases. And so, you know, it's a balance mm-hmm. between the unbiased process of the computer. Even if there's noise, it will find some signal. And then the expertise of the scientist who will really find and evaluate those gems that the computer system has found. It's really interesting because some scientists actually are really willing to take the leap, right? So at Barrow, Dr. Bowser and his colleagues, you know, that protein that only had 7 abstracts, it was kind of hard to say why did Watson think it was linked to ALS because right. there's such little data. And they said, well, you know, we'll trust it, we'll test it. And good for them, you know. Yeah. And we have other clients who are much more hesitant, who say, you know, if I can't understand the entire links, if I don't understand how it came up with this, I'm just not even going to bother. And, you know, I think I understand the doubt in the process. However, I think as scientists, we have to use a bit of trust, you know, and also creativity in how we conduct research. And so I hope that more and more scientists will understand the power of cognitive computing and the power that it can really help them accelerate their day-to-day research.
But that's amazing in a way, because it's not just a matter of the value coming from shaving off time to a drug approval or shaving off cost on the mm-hmm. path there. If you're finding completely unique targets,
mm-hmm. yeah.
that's not just a simple matter of incremental time or cost.
Right.
That's if not for Watson, mm-hmm. we probably never would have found this
yeah,
yet.
Absolutely. And so in the drug repurposing use case is around Parkinson's disease. And I remember the scientist there, she was really excited. Her name is Naomi Visanji, and she found out that some of the top hits that she expected, and she said, okay, the mechanisms of actions are similar to ones that we know. And this is actually for, to be specific, it's for L-DOPA-induced dyskinesia. So it's a side effect of the medication that is given for Parkinson's disease. So just so your listeners know that we're not looking at drugs that affect Parkinson's for this particular use case. And there were a few that, right, had mechanisms of action that really made a lot of sense to her. And then others that were kind of a mystery. And so, again, it comes back to the individual scientists of whether they're willing to take the leap. But she came back to her boss and the other group members, and they all came to the conclusion that, you know what, we're going to try the ones where we don't understand what the mechanism of action is. We're really curious, because the other ones, actually, they make sense. It's boring.
Right.
You know, we want to discover something really new. So it's really exciting, because actually since then, since we did the ranking, a few other labs have come out with proving some of our top hits whose molecular mechanism of action made sense, right? Mm-hmm. So that's a really nice proof point for us. Mm-hmm. But, you know, she's going to go after the ones where we don't understand what the mechanism of action is,
right,
and why it would be efficient against dyskinesia.
Right, and why not?
Right.
Do you refer to IBM Watson as he, she, or it?
I refer to it as it, but if someone says he, I might want to say she. For me, it's it. It's a machine, right? It's not a human. There's no reason to put gender on it. You know, obviously, it was named for one of the CEOs of IBM, and, you know, a really amazing person who's actually talk about wanting to advance society. It was really progressive in its way that it treated its employees, and actually was really there to advance equality. And IBM was one of the first companies that really embraced LGBT employees and women working there, especially in technology, really racial equality as well. So there's really, since a very long time, really pushed for diversity within the company. So for me, yeah, Watson is it. And also, you have to realize it's really a collection of technologies. And for drug discovery, for example, for this specific product, we don't really use the core Watson algorithms. Some of them are shared, but we develop a lot of things that are just very targeted for this product, because it's such a complex problem, life sciences. It's very domain specific.
Okay. Has Watson, in any of its tailor-made iterations, passed the Turing test?
I don't think so at this point, right? I mean, and I don't know whether it's a goal of anybody in the company. No, it's really interesting that you asked me that, because I have to say nobody has talked about it within the company, at least with me. Because we're not trying to make Watson be believable as a human. Mm-hmm. Again, I said it's an it, right? It's there to enhance the capacity of a human, so to be an assistant. So my goal is certainly not that, to be honest. I know that a lot of scientists, you know, are really excited by technology advancement for its own sake. Mm-hmm. I'm not interested in that. I'm interested in it to make a better society. Mm-hmm.
So I cannot interview Watson then.
Right.
I was planning for the next podcast. Did you ever take computer science courses?
I did not take formal computer science courses. I am pretty self-taught. When I was young, there was a lot of stigma, I felt, around math and anything that was technology-driven. So I wasn't really drawn to that, but as I grew older, when I started to discover what math could do was when I was learning neuroscience.
And how did you get to where you are now?
So it was a windy road, actually. You know, I grew up in France, and I could have just stayed in France, right, and done school there. I was a bit of a lost soul because I have so many interests, especially at that point.
Did you come over to the U.S. to go to Berkeley?
I came over to go. My first year was actually at UC Santa Cruz, so I didn't get into Berkeley. I went to just public school.
We have that in common. They also rejected me. Yep.
Yeah.
Way to go, Berkeley.
Yeah. Well, it's hard, right? To know how to select students is really hard. So,
you know, Watson could help with that.
That's right. Probably, you know, by taking, you know, training on applicants that actually succeed.
That's right.
Yeah, that's a good point. So I went to UC Santa Cruz, and there originally it wasn't necessarily I wasn't meant to stay because it was expensive, and in France education is free for the most part. And so, you know, even though I have loans and grants and work study, it was still expensive. So after a year, I actually had to leave because the financial package wasn't enough. And so I went to community college and lived with relatives. So I did that. I'm very grateful that they took me in. Mm-hmm. In any case, I went to the local community college and actually, yeah, studied film there. And I did some filmmaking for a while. And then, like I said, I just, being in the industry for a while, I just realized that although I think, I'm a creative person, I have a very analytical mind and I love learning. And so I just really wanted to pursue a higher degree. And it all turned out really well. I think I'm just incredibly lucky. And there are a lot of people along the way who helped me get to where I am today.
A final question. Let's say you're in elementary school and think this is really cool work. And it's going to be 15 or so years before you could join your team. Mm-hmm. How would you advise such a student, or how would you, if you were that student, how would you position yourself to join the work? Because where will the group be in 15 years?
I see. So I think it's really good to have a mix of domain understanding and sophisticated, you know, abilities in computer science or math or in some quantitative disciplines. So I would say to the student, definitely pursue both. So I would say take basic courses in computer science, physics, math, and then really think about what you enjoy, think about what you care about, whether it's health or social science or maybe finance or whatever it is, and then learn a bunch about that too. But definitely keep those two things in parallel. I think in our modern world, it's going to be really so important to be well-versed in technology. But again, we have to remember that the domain adaptation is crucial. And so we also need experts in those particular domains.
Well, Alix, this was as fun as it was informative. Thank you so much for being a guest on Human Proof of Concept. And next time, bring your little friend.
Thank you. This was really a pleasure.
Thanks for joining me for my conversation with Alix Lacoste of IBM Watson for Drug Discovery. Alix has selected the charity for this month's Press Pause for a Cause. It is Doctors Without Borders. So if you like this free podcast and you're inclined to give back, visit doctorswithoutborders.org or humanpoc.com/cause. Please subscribe to the Human Proof of Concept podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, and Google Play Music. Follow me on Twitter at HumanPOC, visit the website humanpoc.com for show notes and more information, and get email alerts to new podcasts. The soundtrack behind Human Proof of Concept is Three We by the Gordon Webster Trio. The podcast is produced by Shane Williams and EJ Howard. The statements and opinions expressed herein are solely those of the individuals and do not necessarily reflect the views of affiliated organizations.